I wonder, Ed Warren said, puffing on his pipe, if that night long ago felt the same as this one. The night when the survivor's gambit played out. The fall of a regime. The start of a new world.
You can't possibly think this is equivalent, Wax said. The Lord Ruler's reign was one of terror and oppression. These people are upset, yes, but it's a far different world now.
Different, Ed Warren said, letting smoke roll from his mouth as he spoke. Perhaps. But human emotions are the same. It seems that no matter how nice the box is, put a man inside it and he will buck. Fight.
Rail.
And you claim to be on the side of the common man, Wax said dryly.
Hardly. I want power, wealth, influence. Just like the people in the Survivor's crew, actually.
They were heroes.
And thieves.
They were what they had to be.
And Kelsier himself, Ed Warren said. In the years before his grand gambit. What of the Ascendant Warrior, living on the street, scamming noblemen and priests for a living? Have you read the words of Founding, nephew? The Historica speaks frankly about their ambitions. A survivor didn't just want to overthrow the Lord Ruler. He wanted to steal the Empire's riches. He wanted to rule the world that came about upon the Lord Ruler's fall. He wanted power, influence, wealth.
I'm not going down this road, Uncle, Wax said.
Have you ever wondered, Ed Warren mused, ignoring Wax's objection, if you'd get along with them? If you'd lived back then, what would you have seen? A bunch of miscreants? Lawbreakers? Would you have trussed up the Ascendant Warrior and tossed her in a cell? The law is not something holy, son. It's just a reflection of the ideals of those lucky enough to be in charge.
I don't know any constables, Wax said, who think the law is perfect or the courts infallible. But they're the best damn things we have right now, and I'm not going to entertain for a second the idea that you're some kind of secret seeker of justice. You're as rotten as they come, Uncle.
So pleasant, Ed Warren said. And this is what I get for responding to your invitation. Insults and vitriol. And one wonders why our house is considered a laughingstock these days. I'm told they invite you to parties just to see you strut.
I sent to you, Wax said through clenched teeth, because I think we might have a common enemy. I know you want to rule this city. Well, I need you to see reason. I've spoken with the creature. If we don't stop her, there might not be a city to rule.
Ed Warren didn't respond, holding his pipe and looking through the coach's glass window at the curling mists in the darkness just outside.
What do you know? Wax asked, almost a plea. I'm certain the set has been watching events with interest. Your attempt to kill me earlier. Tell me that was just a strike of opportunity. Tell me you aren't working with her. She'll see it all burn, Uncle. Help me bring her down.
Ed Warren mused silently a while, enjoying his pipe.
Do you realize what your overzealous campaign against us has accomplished, nephew?
He finally asked.
Half the city's elements are too frightened to work with the set for fear that you'll show up on their doorstep and shoot their mothers. The money you've seized hasn't ruined us, but it has made some of our members very, very upset.
Good, Wax said.
You say that because you're ignorant, Ed Warren spat. Among the members of the set, I am conservative. I speak against brashness, against violence. The more you shove, however, the weaker my influence becomes, and stronger grow the voices clamoring for change. At any cost.
Oh, Harmony, Wax whispered. You are working with her.
It's more like we are riding the storm, Ed Warren said. Personally, I'd love to see you bring this creature down. It might topple some of my rivals. Give me a chance to propose something audacious of my own to the set. But I'm not going to help you, nephew.
Perhaps this is what needs to be.
How can you do this? Wax asked. You're going to watch it all burn?
Ashes are excellent fertilizer, Edwin said. Unless they pile so high they smother everything.
Edwin drew his lips to a tight line.
You are short-sighted and self-righteous. You were ever so, even during your youth. But still, I love you, nephew. I consider it a sign of that love that I haven't actually had you killed. I keep hoping you'll see we are not your enemy. We are the thieves and miscreants of this day who will someday be hailed as heroes. The men and women who will change the world because... What was it you said? This is what we need to be in order to survive.
And my sister, Wax said, is holding her captive part of what you need to do to survive?
Yes, actually, Edwin said, meeting his eyes. Because I don't doubt that someday I'm going to need to use her against you. Kill me, and your sister is as good as dead, Waxelium.
He knocked again on the ceiling beneath the driver. The carriage slowed to a stop.
Run along now, Edwin said. Go be the toy soldier and pretend you wouldn't have murdered the survivor's entire crew if you'd lived under the Lord Ruler. Try to pretend you went out into the roughs to find justice, and not because you realized life in this city was just too damn hard for you.
They sat in the quiet, immobile coach. Wax held himself steady, though Edwin's eyes flicked toward Wax's shoulder holster as if he was expecting Wax to draw. He could. He could shoot this man right here and now. He'd broken promises before, and to far better men than his uncle.
Kill me and your sister is as good as dead.
Wax kicked the door open. I'm going to go deal with this Chandra, but know that I won't forget you, uncle. One day you're going to find me standing behind you with a gun to your head, and you'll have the sudden, horrible realization that there's nothing left that can protect you.
I look forward to it, Edwin said. If that day doesn't come before next summer, you should join me for Meriwether dinner. We'll have stuffed pig in your honor.
Wax growled softly, but stepped from the coach and slammed the door. 18. Marcy had spent a great portion of her adult life preparing to be an attorney, and her mother had wished her to someday find her way to politics. Marcy had abandoned aspirations toward politics in her youth, and had recently abandoned the solicitors as well. The thing was, those professions had one important flaw. They were populated entirely with attorneys and politicians. Despite her best efforts, she now found herself in a room full of them. Governor Innate stood by the hearth here, in his private study, one arm resting on the mantel. Arrayed before him were the men and women of his executive staff, a hearty bunch who didn't seem nearly as groggy as the constables and guards who had been called up in the middle of the night. In fact, the group displayed a distinct energy as they discussed the crisis. Their words tumbled over one another in their eagerness to express their opinions, like children vying for parental approval. Marcy stood beside the window, where the governor had put her, saying he'd get to her later. So she waited, listened, and circumspectly took notes on her pad. If the Chandra happened to be hiding among them, she doubted a verbal slip would enable her to recognize Bleeder, but it seemed the best use of her time as long as she was required to stay put.
"It will all blow over," repeated the city sanitation director. He was an attorney who had been through the same program she'd completed, albeit many years ago.
Marcy wasn't sure why he needed a law degree to run city sanitation.
"Rep, you're taking this too seriously."
"I am taking an attempt on my life too seriously?" Innate asked. "An attack that left one of my lifelong friends dead?"
That brought a stillness to the room, and the sanitation director settled back down, red-faced. Innate had changed his shirt from the one stained red with blood, but Marcy knew they all had seen him before he'd done so. She rather thought he'd delayed changing until they had.
"I wasn't talking about the assassination attempt," the sanitation director said. "I meant the ruckus outside. It will blow over."
"They're already looting,"
the Minister of Trade noted, a bespectacled woman who had brought two aides to take notes for her. She hadn't offered them seats.
There will always be looting, the sanitation director said. It happens. We hunker down, let burn what needs to burn. Contain rather than try to stamp out.
Foolishness,
said the Secretary of Education, a corpulent woman who sat with her feet up by the crackling fire.
This is a time for decisiveness, my lord. You need to show your rivals that you are not easily cowed. You know the Lacalls have been getting traction lately, and your brother's scandal will only fuel their ambition. Mark my words, they will present a strong candidate to rival you at the next election, and he will lean on this night's events to discredit you.
Yes, said the Minister of Public Affairs. Could they be behind the assassination attempt, perhaps?
The governor glanced toward Maracy, the first time he'd acknowledged her since the meeting had begun. He knew about Milan now. She'd shown her true nature to him just before the meeting started. He believed, and had begun by explaining to the executive staff about the rogue Condra. The others obviously considered it foolishness, and, after the way of their kind, were simply ignoring what he'd told them. Maracy met his gaze calmly. Once upon a time she had dreamed of being a participant in meetings like this one. Gatherings where important decisions were made, where laws were drafted and political strategies adopted. Now she found herself frustrated by all the talk. Waxillium was rubbing off on her, and perhaps not in ways she should appreciate.
Now, the sanitation director said. The Lacalls aren't behind this. An assassin? Are you mad, Daunton? They would never be caught engaging in something so potentially damaging.
Agreed, said the Secretary of Education. This was someone far more desperate. I repeat, my Lord Governor, decisiveness, leadership. You asked about martial law. Well, that is the minimum you must do, I say. Send the constables out in force. Crush the looters. Scatter the rioters. Be seen protecting the city.
Others voiced their opinions on this, and the governor quieted them.
I'll consider.
His tone was sharp, sharper than Maracy had heard from him before.
Out with you all. I need to think.
In that moment, he looked haggard. The counselors quieted, then made their way out. Maracy moved to join them, reluctantly.
Miss Colmes,
the governor said, walking to his desk.
A moment.
Maracy obeyed, stepping up before the desk as he settled down. He reached to the floor, pushing back the rug and exposing the top of a small safe which he absently unlocked with a key from his desk. He reached inside, taking out his seal of office, then settled down to begin writing.
Tell Constable General Auradel that he has his writ of martial law, the governor said tiredly. He's the only constable general to contact me so far, which I find disturbing. I am appointing him with executive authority as Lord High Constable, director of all law enforcement offices in the city until this crisis is over. The other Octans constable generals will need to report to him.
Maracy didn't reply. The others weren't going to like that. The rivalry among the Octant precincts was officially characterized as friendly, but in reality had far too much bite to it for her taste.
And your instructions regarding the people of the city? Maracy asked softly as he wrote. Should the constables do as your education secretary suggests?
Innate finished writing. He looked up at her and seemed to weigh her with his eyes.
You're new to the constabulary, I believe. The cousin of Lord Ladrian's betrothed?
I wasn't aware I had attracted your attention, Maracy said.
You haven't. He has. Damnable man.
Maracy remained silent, feeling awkward before his judgmental gaze.
Those mobs will end up here sooner or later, you know, the governor said, tapping his pen on the table. They'll come demanding answers. I must speak to them. Turn this tide.
Speak to them? Maracy thought. As you did earlier?
That speech hadn't shown any particular sense of empathy. Rusts, had that only been this afternoon? Checking the governor's ornate desk clock, she found it was almost 2. So the governor's speech had technically been yesterday. She probably shouldn't have looked at the time. Seeing exactly how late it was merely reminded her of her own exhaustion. It was like an angry creditor pounding on her door. She'd be able to ignore it for only so long.
Tell Aurodel, the governor mused, not to stop the people from converging here at the mansion, but he is to beat down any looters in other parts of the city. Put the fear of the sword into them. I'll need a force of constables here, of course, to keep the masses who come to me in check, but I do want to speak to them. This will be a night for history to be made.
Sir, Marcy said, I know a thing or two about the mentality of crowds. If you wish... Someone outside called for Nate, and he stood in the middle of Marcy's sentence. He shoved the writ toward her, sealed with his stamp, then marched out to deal with the questions. Marcy watched him go with a sigh. Hopefully Wayne and that Condro woman would be able to assure his safety. She'd happily see Innate incarcerated someday, but she didn't wish him dead. His assassination would be, among other things, terrible for city morale. She stored the writ beside her pistol in her purse, then walked from the room and slipped through the hallway where many of the cabinet members were giving orders to aides and accepting cups of steaming black tea from household staff. Wayne lounged in a corner, feet up on an end table and spinning an expensive golden mahogany pen between his fingers. Harmony knew where he'd stolen that. Unfortunately, her motor needed a refueling, so she'd have to use more mundane methods to run the writ to Aurodel. She found the footman and ordered a carriage. The haggard footman, however, shook his head.
It will be a few minutes, miss, before I can dredge up a coach. The executive staff have half the cabs in the city running notes for them, and on a night like this one, no less.
He glanced meaningfully toward the open door. Outside, the porch lights barely penetrated the mists. They curled and danced, almost timid. Tiny wisps would creep into the entry hall, then vanish almost immediately like steam over a stove.
I will wait, Marcy said. Thank you.
He seemed pleased by her response. Perhaps others had been less understanding. As he was called away, Marcy idled in the doorway, staring into the mists. That orange haze over the city wasn't normal. Fires were burning out there. If they were lucky, those flames would only be masked lanterns and torches, not buildings. Standing there strongly reminded her of something that she couldn't put her finger on. She shook her head and walked back into the mansion with a half-mind to find Wayne and see what he thought of recent events. In the large sitting room, beyond the entryway, she passed a weary serving man scrubbing the wooden floor. The bloodstains were stubborn, it appeared. The man had already discreetly rolled the rug up against the wall for disposal. Marcy passed him and, changing her mind about finding Wayne, instead walked down the stairs toward the hidden chamber. A city close to breaking, she thought as she reached the bottom. This has happened before. In the confined space, the air still smelled of the soap that had been used to clean up the blood. The empty safe room had a quiet, scholastic feel about it, with all those books on the walls. There was no overhead lighting, just the lamps shaded a soft red-orange. She walked around the room, noting the many volumes of the Full Words of Founding when she passed it on the wall. The leather-bound books seemed pristine, and on a whim she pulled the first one out and checked it. The pages were uncut, as sometimes happened in new books. This volume had obviously never been read. Long ago, the survivor had pushed a city to the brink of destruction, then channeled that fury into a rebellion that had overthrown a millennium-long dictatorship. Every student learned of those days, but Marcy had read the detailed accounts, including of the night when it had all come to a head. She could imagine it had been a night very much like this one. Only instead of the survivor, this time it had been induced by a psychotic murderer.
She has to be doing it on purpose, Marcy thought, walking through the room. Trying to echo that night when the Lord Ruler fell. A people on the brink of insurrection, noble houses at each other's throats, and now...
Now a speech. The governor would have his moment before the crowd and they would sense the resonance even if they couldn't put their finger on it. They'd been taught about that night since childhood. They would listen to him and expect him to be like the last emperor who had spoken long ago on the night of the Lord Ruler's death. The last emperor had come to power because of his heartfelt words that night. But Governor Innate was not Elend Venture. Far from it.
Marcy suddenly stopped and backed up a few steps. She'd been walking beside the built-in bookcases, paying little conscious attention to them, but just enough to have noticed something off. Here, on this long shelf of pristine books, were three in a row with spines scuffed at the bottom. What distinguished these books? They were part of a 7-volume collection of dry political treatises written long ago by the Counselor of Gods. She took one and flipped through it, finding nothing of interest. Perhaps Innate had been studying lately. But why were only the 3rd, 4th, and 5th volumes scuffed? She picked up another and opened it, and here she found the reason. Cut into the center of the pages was a hole containing a key. Innate hadn't been reading Breeze's old essays. He had simply forgotten which volume had the key in it. Marcy held up the key, then glanced at the room's solitary desk. Dared she?
Of course I dare,
she thought, crossing the room with a swish of skirts. Her constable credentials, plus Aradel's concern about the governor, would give her legal grounds for doing a quick search. She knew the law as well as anyone. She also knew that the law was subject to interpretation by the city's judges, most of whom had noble blood and would not take kindly to someone spying on the governor. That was why her fingers were trembling as she quickly tried the key in the desk drawer. It didn't fit. She paused, then tried a spot on the floor like the one up above, where the governor had gotten out his seal. Sure enough, there was a hidden safe under the rug. She turned the key in it and earned a satisfying click. She pulled the safe open and quickly scanned the contents. A pistol. Cigars, she didn't recognize the brand. A bundle of banknotes tied with string, enough to buy a house. Marcy's eyes bulged a little, but she kept searching. A stack of letters. These she took over to the desk, expecting to find details of an illicit romantic relationship or the like. She skimmed them, then read more deeply, then sank down into the desk's chair, raising her fingers to her lips. The letters did detail a relationship, or rather, many of them. These were private communications with house leaders throughout the city. Although couched in euphemism and circumlocution, to her they clearly spoke of corruption. Marcy grew cold as she flipped through them letter by letter. The actual writing was opaque. We agree that certain courtesies will be extended, or these are acceptable terms as per our previous arrangement. But they were dated, and her mind quickly related each of them to her notes back at the precinct. This was proof. She flipped through more. Yes, they aligned with her own statistical analysis. These were Innate's promises of political favors in exchange for bribes. With obfuscatory language, it might not be a smoking gun, but it was at least a very warm one. Better, Innate had added notations to most of the letters to remind himself of important points. Here was one, probably trading a promise by Innate to push for higher tariffs on refined steel from outside the city, in exchange for a favorable deal on a land purchase by one of his family. Another more recent one was about a judge's seat, when Innate had appointed a Hammondes scion to a recent opening. She'd suspected corruption, but this was jarring, seeing it discussed like this in black and white. She sifted through the stack. No letters to the Lacals, his primary rivals. None to Axilium, either, Marcy saw with relief. Nor any older ones to Edworn Ladrian, Waxilium's uncle. Under the letters was a ledger which she expected would show what Innate thought he was still owed, and would also record the state of his private accounts. Flipping through quickly didn't tell her enough to be certain, but it did seem reasonable. Marcy sat holding it all, feeling overwhelmed. Rusts. The people are right to be in revolt. Was this the crux of Bleeder's plan? Shove Innate into the limelight, then undermine him by exposing his corruption? Indeed, the corrupt nature of virtually every noble family in the city? In revealing these letters, Marcy could be playing into the creature's hands. That made her sick. If he was this corrupt, didn't he need to be exposed and removed? She hurriedly tucked the letters into her purse. Captain Aradel needed to see this. Marcy quickly shut and locked the safe, put back the key, and then started up the steps. She didn't want to be in the basement when the footman came looking for her to announce her carriage.
Innate will claim they were planted by Bleeder, Marcy thought as she reached ground level. He'll have an easy out.
Beyond that, if he noticed they were gone, he'd have a pretty good idea of who took them. That same servant was still cleaning up, and he'd seen Marcy go down and return. But rust and ruin. She wasn't going to just ignore something like this. Flying through the air at night let Wax see the distinct presence of humankind as marked by strict boundaries. Where they dwelled, there was illumination. Pinpricks in the darkness, men and women sticking a claim on the night. The lights spread like the roots of a tree. His uncle had left him far from where he wanted to be. Fortunately, for a coin shot, even the vastness of Ellendale was manageable. He didn't immediately turn inward, however, to visit the Chondra homeland. His uncle's words haunted him, and before those, Bleeder's jibes. They attacked from two different directions, like pins pushed into either temple. He needed to think, to be alone. Perhaps then he could sort through what this mess meant. He landed on a rooftop overlooking the vast, glowing carpet of lights before him. A cat watched him from a nearby flower box, its eyes alight. Below was another row of pubs. Loud, raucous. Surely it was past 2 in the morning, yet they showed no signs of quieting down. Rust saw he hated that one could never feel truly alone in the city. Even in the privacy of his mansion, the quiet was marred by the incessant passage of carriages outside. He leaped away into the night, frightening the cat. He soared high in a long arc, trying to get far enough away that he couldn't hear the men shouting drunkenly in the row of pubs. His search took him eastward toward the edge of the city. As he approached, something emerged from the mists, like the bleached spine of some ancient monster. Eastbridge, a massive construction that spanned the Iron Gate River here. On one hand, he marveled that humankind could create something like this, an enormous, riveted marvel, big enough to let motors pass and also hold railroad tracks. On the other hand, the mists completely engulfed the bridge, giving it an even more skeletal cast. Humankind would create and take pride in those creations, but Harmony's presence could make it all seem trivial. Did he know? Wax landed atop one of the bridge's towers, boots clanging. Could he have saved Lessie? The answer was simple. Of course Harmony had known. To believe in a god was to accept that he or she wasn't going to deliver you from every problem. It wasn't something Wax had ever dwelled on. Living in the roughs, he'd accepted that sometimes you just had to weather things on your own. Help didn't always come. That was life. You dealt with it. But now, something felt different. He'd spoken to Harmony. Hell, Wax was out here right now because of a request from God himself. That made it all the more personal. God hadn't saved Lessie, hadn't given Wax warning. And now he expected Wax to just hop to it and do as he demanded? And what would you do? Wax addressed himself, walking along the bridge's lofty pinnacle. Let the city burn? Let Bleeder keep killing? Of course he couldn't. Harmony knew that too. He had Wax by the throat.
Are you there?
Wax asked, sending the thought out. Harmony? He felt at his ear before remembering he'd taken out his earring. By necessity, yes, but in that moment he was glad not to have it. Not to let God get a purchase on his mind, for the thoughts he had weren't particularly pious. Wax strode through the mists, while down below a lone motor car puttered across the bridge. Bleeder was toying with him. He could feel her fingers sneaking in, piercing his skull, wrapping around his mind. He could see exactly what she was doing, yet couldn't banish the questions she raised. Wax paused at one end of the tower's top. From here, he could see the edge of the city, where the lights gave way to the darkness of the countryside. Behind him, the city was a brilliant blaze, thousands upon thousands of lights, but the electric lines hadn't yet come out past the bridge. On the outskirts of Ellendale, the lights stopped. The last few hung on the bridge, like lighthouses looking out at the vast blackness of the sea. He yearned for that darkness, to leap out into it, escape all this responsibility, stop needing to worry about hundreds of thousands of people he couldn't know, and get back to helping the few